WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
It's been a long time coming.
A long, 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 long time before the dawn.
Long Time Gone is one of the records that made Crosby, Stills, and Nash one of rock's most popular groups of the late 60s and early 70s. It's also the title of David Crosby's new autobiography. Crosby was a founding member of the Byrds, and later with Stephen Stills and Graham Nash formed Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Frankly, many of Crosby's friends and fans thought he'd be dead by now. His longtime addiction to heroin and cocaine left him paranoid, dissipated, and nearly non-functional, and resulted in one of the most public declines in rock history. Crosby was busted on drug and weapons charges and spent 11 months of 1985 and 86 in prison, where he was forced to go cold turkey. Crosby says he's now drug-free, he's making a comeback, and has a forthcoming solo album, as well as an album with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I asked him if writing his autobiography was a cathartic experience.
Unquestionably. You got to understand that I did lots of things that I am very unhappy about. But you can't just let them sit there in your head. They'll sort of fester on you, and you, at the same time, can't dwell on them. And writing all of this down and going through the process of having to, sift through it and find what was significant and what wasn't, and then I put it in some communicable form, was actually a great help to me in dealing with, everything that I've been through.
Let's talk a little bit about your music. Your father was a cinematographer. You went to prep school, and shortly after you got out of prep school, you went right to Greenwich Village and started performing there. In the folk and the rock music scenes, where did you see yourself fitting in?
I didn't. It wasn't as if I planned any of it. I had always thought that I would want to, go into films because, as you say, my father was a cinematographer and made films, and I thought, that was a pretty glamorous, attractive thing to do. But I just wound up with a guitar in my hand singing, and that was it. As soon as I did it, I said, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to do.
Would you describe that first night that you sat in uninvited with Roger McGuinn and Gene Clark right before you together formed the Byrds?
Oh, gee. If only my memory were that clear. I can give you a generic version. We were all three hanging around the Troubadour in Los Angeles, which at the time was the folk club in Los Angeles. And, we had all obviously heard the Beatles records, and we were all trying to do that. And Gene was able to write, sort of Beatlesque sort of changes, and Roger could play them. And the effect of Roger playing them in his sort of folky style on a 12-string, an acoustic 12-string, at that time we didn't have any electric instruments, was startling. And I have been singing harmony since I was about 6 years old and just jumped on it like white on rice and instantly loved it, and they loved it, and the rest was history, as they say.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song
kind of asked to leave the Byrds.
I was thrown out.
You were thrown out. What was that about? What did McGuinn tell you? What did Roger McGuinn tell you when he asked you to leave?
Well, Roger and Christopher, who, by the way, now are both very good friends of mine, at that time were very frustrated with me being, you know, such an egotist and a pushy guy. And I was very frustrated. I felt I was being held back. I was blossoming as a writer, and I felt, you know, that I had been locked into a role of being the guy who played rhythm guitar and sang harmony. I thought I was better than that, and I wanted more of my tunes on the records, and yada, yada, yada. You know, it was all, you know, kind of just growing pains mixed with some ego and stuff.
Shortly after getting thrown out of the Byrds, you formed another band, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, with Stephen Stills, who had been with the Buffalo Springfield, and Graham Nash, who had been with the Hollies. Did you take a different approach to harmony than you did with the Byrds?
I did once Graham showed up, I'll tell you that.
How is it different?
Well, that's three-part.
Uh-huh.
It's a whole other ballgame.
So what kind of place did you have to find for your voice?
Well, I wound up having to sing what I am proud to say is probably the most difficult part, the middle part, which has to accommodate the other two parts. If we did anything really that I'm proud of in terms of singing harmony, though, it was that we managed to be pretty inventive about it. And I think that's one of the reasons that we, you know, achieved the kind of strange sound that we did.
Getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore.
I am sorry.
Sometimes it hurts so badly I must cry out loud.
I am lonely.
I am yours, you are mine, you are what you are.
You make it hard.
Remember what we said.
Well, you were singing songs that were very popular among hippies who were doing a lot of marijuana and LSD and celebrating psychedelic drugs. You were already onto much harder drugs. You were doing cocaine. You got involved in heroin. You started freebasing early on when freebasing was invented, so to speak.
Yeah, probably more earlier than most people. It was mid-70s, I would say, I started really doing that. When I started out, though, I started out doing the same thing everybody else did, which was smoking joints and psychedelics. And you get to understand, at the beginning, that was a very innocuous thing. You know, it seemed perfectly all right to do. And if you were around, you would remember that when cocaine first came on the scene, everybody told you that wasn't addictive either. Well, turns out that's not the case. And then, of course, when I graduated to freebasing, which is much worse than snorting cocaine, ladies and gentlemen, it got much worse.
Well, you took a lot of risks, not only with your health, but with where you were freebasing. You started freebasing in your car while driving.
Yes, I did.
Freebasing in commercial airliners.
I did that, too.
Keeping the stuff underneath some kind of poncho or something so no one could see. It's amazing that you didn't get killed or busted long before drugs.
Oh, there were much worse ways of getting killed. I did almost die from heroin overdoses. One of the things that happens to you that I don't know if you do know about is that when you do enough cocaine, you get to the point where you have seizures from toxic saturation. I had them, I had one driving a car down the freeway. I took out 100 yards of crash fencing. I could have killed other people. I came so close to death a number of times that I am, like, as you are, I am amazed that I'm alive.
Well, after you started having seizures, your friends realized that you were really near death and that if they didn't take some kind of action, that you'd be gone. And a lot of your friends gathered to try to convince you to go into rehabilitation. Who were some of the people who were there?
It's called an intervention.
Right, okay.
And it's a known tool of, you know, drug rehabilitation. And in my case, it didn't work.
Why didn't it work?
Well, you know, that's what they said. But they really don't understand that when you get past a certain point, that the drugs have their own power. You know, I can remember saying, I'm not going to do this. And I'd look down and there would be the torch and the pipe in my hands and I'd be doing it.
Tomorrow, David Crosby talks about kicking his drug habit during his year-long imprisonment. This is Fresh Air.